Coming up next on Passion Struck.
If I could come up with one synonym for branding, it would be consistency. So you need to be consistent in your messaging. So that means coming up with 4 or 5 points that you repeat over and over again, that people know that's what you represent. That's how you get auto engagement, where people will just share your picture because they already know what you represent.
Welcome to Passion Struck. Hi, I'm your host, John R. Miles. And on the show, we decipher the secrets, tips, and guidance of the world's most inspiring people and turn their wisdom into practical advice for you and those around you. Our mission is to help you unlock the power of intentionality so that you can become the best version of yourself. If you're new to the show, I offer advice and answer listener questions on Fridays. We have long-form interviews the rest of the week with guests ranging from astronauts to authors, CEOs, creators, innovators, scientists, military leaders, visionaries, and athletes. Now, let's go out there and become Passion Struck.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 496 of Passion Struck. A heartfelt thank you to each and every one of you who return to the show every week, eager to listen, learn, and discover new ways to live better, to be better, and most importantly, to make a meaningful impact in the world. If you're new to the show, thank you so much for being here. Or you simply want to introduce this to a friend or a family member, and we so appreciate it when you invite your friends and family. We have episode starter packs, which are collections of our fans' favorite episodes that we put in convenient playlists that give any new listener a great way to get acclimated to everything we do here on the show. Especially now that we have almost 500 episodes, we have so much rich content for you to discover. You can find these playlists at either Spotify or passionstruck.com/starterpacks. Before we dive into today's episode, I received incredible news that my book Passion Struck won Best Business Book and Best Ebook at the International Business Awards, known as the Stevie Award. For those who are not familiar, the Stevie Award is the world's premier business awards and are equivalent to winning an Oscar. We also won gold and silver medals at the Global Book Awards and hit the top 50 books in the Amazon Kindle store. What an incredible week. You can purchase the book anywhere that you buy books, but recently it's been on sale for 99 cents on Kindle. In case you missed my interviews from last week, they featured Shalini Sharma and Rob Kalvarowski. Shalini is a leading math learning expert and CEO on a mission to prove that math is for everyone. Shalini's new book, Math Mind, The Simple Path to Loving Math, debunks myths about math and highlights its beauty and creativity. Join us as we explore how math can enhance problem-solving skills, create career opportunities, and engage us fully in the digital world. Rob is a distinguished leadership coach who combines neuroscience, mindset coaching, and high-performance strategies to unlock leaders' potential. Rob, an MIT grad and former water polo team co-captain, delves into the masks we wear, toxic leadership, and how leaders can foster a high-performing, authentic organizational culture. Discover powerful insights and practical solutions for transformative leadership. And as always, I wanted to say thank you so much for your ratings, your reviews, and supporting me on the book. If you love today's episode, we would appreciate you giving it a 5-star review and sharing it with your friends and families. We would also love to hear what guests and what topics you would like to hear from us. In today's episode of Passion Struck, I am privileged to host my friend Hala Taha, the dynamic force behind the Young and Profiting podcast, which I was just on recently. Go check it out in case you missed my interview with her. Hala isn't just a podcast host. She is the founder and CEO of Yap Media, a full-service podcast production and marketing agency that caters to top podcasters, celebrities, and CEOs. Through Yap Media Network, Hala has created an exclusive community of self-improvement and business podcasts. Hala's journey into the world of audio storytelling began at the New Jersey Institute of Technology, where her passion and skills landed her an internship at WQHT's Hot 97, the premier station for hip-hop and R&B globally. There, Hala honed her craft as an interim producer of The Angie Martinez Show, dedicating 3 years and eventually stepping away from college to immerse herself fully in the radio scene, even working for free to pursue her passion. Today, we'll dive deep into Hala's compelling narrative of overcoming rejection and failure to becoming a podcast powerhouse. We'll explore her secrets to profiting in life, her expertise in personal branding, and her strategic use of LinkedIn. She truly is an expert here to amplify influence and establish a robust online presence. Also, Hala will share her insights on podcast growth, building community, sponsorships, and monetization strategies that have proven successful in the competitive world of podcasting that I know so well. Join us as we uncover the science of influence both online and in real life, delve into LinkedIn and Instagram growth hacks, and learn how to convert an online community into a loyal customer base ready to buy. This is such an episode packed with invaluable lessons for anyone looking to profit from their passions and influence. Thank you for choosing Passionstruck and choosing me to be your host and guide on your journey to creating an intentional life. Now, let that journey begin. I am absolutely thrilled today to have Hala Taha on Passionstruck. Welcome, Hala.
Hi, John. So happy to be here.
So I always love to introduce our guests to the audience by going into your backstory. Could you take us back to your first days at Hot 97? And what was it about radio that captured your heart?
Oh my gosh. I feel like one of my favorite memories in my career journey was working at Hot 97. I got my job there when I was just 19 years old. It actually wasn't a paid job. I was a glorified intern. And basically, my days running in Hot 97, I remember I was responsible to do all the research for the morning show. So the Angie Martinez show, which was the number one show in America, I was responsible to answer all the phones, run the contests. Eventually, they had me reading commercials and getting featured on the show. And at night, I would host parties and showcases and sell showcase tickets. And I really got like my sales skills during that time period. And I was even like blogging on the side for the DJs and just like really just getting my hands wet and all these different things that I ended up using these skills later on in my life to create my social media agency and my podcast and everything like that. So I just remember Hot 97 being like so many wonderful memories of me just really falling in love with broadcasting. And I think what really opened my eyes about what I was doing at the station is at the time I was in college and I actually wanted to work at a radio station to push my music. I was songwriting. I was a singer my whole life. I wanted to be a singer. And as I was doing both at the same time, working at the radio station and trying to write music, I realized that I could use my voice in a positive way. And it didn't necessarily have to be recording and writing music. And I realized that in order to be a pop star, I really had to give up a lot of my life. I probably have to move around a lot. I wasn't the best dancer in the world. I was a good dancer, but I was no Beyonce. And I felt like competition-wise, I probably couldn't really compete and it would be a really uphill battle. But with radio and broadcasting, I felt like I had a chance to be the next Angie Martinez, to be the next voice of New York. And so I really just like kept on that path and I got really passionate about radio.
Then you made the switch from radio to podcasting. What do you think were some of the unexpected hurdles that you faced when you made that transition?
Well, I actually had a big gap before I made that transition. I had about 5 years where I was blogging and then I worked in corporate where I wasn't on a mic any longer. And I remember being in corporate, I was at Hewlett Packard my fourth year, and I was feeling like, man, like I want to go back to my passions. I feel like I'm not satisfied with what I'm doing. I could be helping more people. I could be doing more with my own life. I wanted to start building my own brand, building my own business. So I launched Young and Profiting Podcast. And at the time, podcasting was a lot more accessible because even when I worked at Hot 97, it was about 12 years ago, 13 years ago, podcasting was still like a very vague thing. Like, there was like multiple steps to listen to a podcast and like nobody really like knew even how to listen to a podcast, but it existed. So by the time in 2018, when I actually launched my own podcast, there was things like Podbean, which is a hosting provider that's really just like you sign up and you just fill in the buttons and you've got a podcast suddenly, right? So it's like way easier. And I didn't overthink it. It wasn't video at the time. I just had a mic and I was still working corporate. And I was like, let me just give this a shot. And I started doing interviews during lunchtime and I started this journey on LinkedIn where I became one of the biggest influencers on LinkedIn and just started posting daily. And here we are 6 years later, a top 100 podcast.
Well, I think it's interesting because when I got my start, I was on Podbean as well. And I did it for the same reason. I wanted a low entry barrier. I didn't know if it was going to work out or not. and I wanted something that was going to be easy, because when I started, not sure about you, but I did every single aspect of the podcast myself, mm-hmm. which I think it has paid dividends now, because I know how to do everything and what I expect and what I expect others to do. But I think back to those early days, and you really had Jordan Harbinger, you had Emily Morse, mm-hmm. maybe Tim Ferriss, but you think back of the people who were in this early on. Do you ever find yourself trying to compare yourself to them? I know you and I have talked before about Benjamin Hardy and his Gap versus Gain book. How do you think about that when you think of those who've preceded you now?
I thought about it all the time, especially when I first started. I remember feeling, man, I'm never going to reach Jordan Harbinger status. And I remember actually obsessing over the fact that I wasn't getting a lot of Apple downloads and I wasn't rising up the ranks on Apple. And for a long time, my show was almost stagnant. I felt like I had stagnant growth. I was growing really fast on LinkedIn. And there was just something that I hadn't figured out. And really what helped me break out of it is I started to think about, like, what actually makes me a successful podcaster? Is it being a number one podcaster on Apple, or can I be the number one podcaster on LinkedIn, on CastBox, on Player FM, on Overcast, on all these other apps? And maybe if I concentrate on everything except Apple, I'll be different and I can be successful that way. And that's exactly what I did. So I just switched my strategy. Instead of trying to do something that seemed impossible, because you already had all these legacy podcasters that had basically taken over Apple and there really wasn't any more room to play there, I started thinking about, what are all the different podcast apps out there? There's 70 other podcast apps in this world. And I had this platform that I could leverage, which was LinkedIn. And I thought, okay, I could trade my audience that I've built on LinkedIn with these other podcast players. Because at the time I was in corporate, I was making some money, but I wasn't like multi-million-dollar entrepreneur yet. I had to get scrappy and resourceful. So I decided, okay, I'm going to reach out. I'm going to just, like, the same way that I find guests on my podcast, that I teach my team to find guests and find contact information, I'm going to give them a list of 100 different platforms and podcast-related blogs and software companies, my hosting provider, my recording platform, my mic choice of hardware, like whatever I could think of. And I'm going to write this email and have them blast it out, customize it, and basically say, hey, my name's Hala. I'm the number one podcaster on LinkedIn. I've got this audience of entrepreneurs and corporate professionals who love my stuff. I get 2 million views on LinkedIn a month. I'll write a post about your blog, your podcast app, your email list, whatever it is, in exchange for you promoting me in your app, in exchange for you putting me on your website, and so on. And so I did this one summer and my podcast blew up. I got like literally X downloads, and then I became the number one podcaster on CastBox, for example. Again, I was already a top podcaster on LinkedIn. I got on the cover of Podcast Magazine, and suddenly I was achieving my dream of being a top podcaster. And I still had barely a following on Apple, but it didn't matter because I had a following on all these other platforms. And because of that, it started to cross-pollinate on Apple. And then I started getting bigger on Apple as well.
Hold the audience in suspense for a little bit, because I want to go into some of the ways that you built that LinkedIn following.
Sure.
So I want people to hold on for that. But I want to go back to your time at Hewlett-Packard, because you and I worked for similar companies. I worked for Dell, you worked for HP. Mm-hmm. And it's ironic because we were both experiencing the same mindset at the time. We were both feeling stagnant in what we were doing and wanting to do something differently. Mm-hmm. And I know that this is something that I talk about a lot. People get stuck where they're at, and a lot of them end up, even though they're stuck, end up staying there. Or even worse, they go from that job to just another one and continue doing the same thing over and over again. What would be your advice to a listener on how do you break that cycle, and how did you do it?
Yeah, I think a lot of the things that keep people back is their perspectives about what everybody else is going to think about them, right? So I remember when I wanted to make the transition to become a podcaster, and I started this like side hustle, essentially, I remember that I got pushback from everyone. My best friends told me I was too old to start a podcast. I just turned 30 and they told me I was too old to start a podcast, even though they knew that for years before that I was in radio and I had a blog and I had always loved that kind of stuff. I had a boyfriend that I was with for 10 years that wasn't really that supportive and thought that I was distracting myself. And how could I be so selfish? You've got this corporate job, you got an MBA, you got a 4.0, you should just stick to what you're doing. You're making six figures. How could you? Right. So I had guilt from him about how I was ruining our lives by following my passion. My parents were skeptical. They were like, hey, you just finally started to make money in corporate. Why are you switching gears again? You failed in the past. Like, just be careful. They were a little bit more supportive, but they also were worried. And the thing is that you never want to take advice from people who have not been where you have already been. And the only person in my life that I can remember that actually gave me advice to take a leap was Heather Monahan, who we talked about offline, who in a different situation, I didn't know her when I started my podcast, but I knew her right before I was about to start my company, Yap Media. And I remember I was working in corporate at the time. I was working at Disney. And at HP, I wasn't thinking about becoming an entrepreneur because I was getting promoted every 6 months. I thought that I was just going to eventually become the CMO. I was very happy. They had an awesome culture. They accepted me. I started as an intern. So everybody saw me grow up and really treated me with a lot of respect, even though I look really young. I literally look about 10 years younger than I really am. And I loved my job at HP. I ended up getting poached to Disney, and I did not like my job at Disney. It was a boys' club. It was 2 years of me busting my butt, getting treated like an intern, not getting promoted, even though I knew I was a superstar. And so I really started to lean into my podcast more and just work on it harder. And at one point, I was getting approached by Heather Monahan, who basically wanted to be my first client. And I had a volunteer team of about 20 interns because, again, I was working full-time jobs. So I had trained all these interns and volunteers who were super fans of the podcast to help me with audio editing and graphic design and social media and whatever I needed help with. I was teaching them skills and they were happy to learn. And I was able to keep my full-time job. So that's how I like kept my podcast afloat for 2 years while running a full-time job. So Heather Monahan comes out of the blue right when COVID started. And she's just like, I love your videos. I love your content. I want to become your first client. And I remember, again, this back to your original question, this feeling of like being scared to take a jump. And I literally, at the time of me wanting to quit my job at Disney, I had started my social media agency as a side hustle. I had about maybe five big clients already making $100,000 a month. I had 30 employees around the world, mostly paid because I started paying everybody. And I still was working my job at Disney because I was afraid to become an entrepreneur. And I remember calling Heather and her screaming at me in the grocery store that because I was worried because my boyfriend was threatening to break up with me. My parents didn't want me to become an entrepreneur. Everybody was upset at me that I wanted to quit Disney. And I literally felt like I was burning myself out, working till 1 a.m. every day, trying to keep everything afloat, my job and this new business. And Heather was like, don't listen to people who have never been where you want to be. You are a successful entrepreneur. You're already successful. And she was like, quit your job. Like, you have to quit your job. And she was the only person that gave me the push to quit my job. And then I did. And everything skyrocketed as soon as I quit my job. And all the people that needed to be removed from my life that were not actually in alignment with wanting to become me to become the best version of myself disappeared. And all the people who were supportive appeared. And so I think the moral of the story is you don't listen to people who've never been where you want to go. Heather Monahan started her own company. She already was an entrepreneur. She was a speaker. She was an author. She's everything that I want. She was already a successful podcaster. She was everything that I wanted to be in the future, telling me, hey, I know you could do it. Trust me. I've been here before. And I did. So I think that's the moral of the story.
Loving that you brought her up, and she is really a clear example of someone who herself was a senior executive. If I think about it correctly, she was in the radio industry, I think.
Yep.
And herself was getting some rejections and feeling the pain, and she decided to do something different. And it's interesting because you look at where she's gone now, and she's probably arguably one of the top 20 speakers in the world on stages all over the place. So I think her advice is really sound, and it's something that I have always tried to do myself when I look at mentors who I've had. I've always tried to find someone who was a job or two ahead of where I wanted to be who's already gone through the failures and the missteps and everything else. So you get someone who's guiding you, so you're not repeating those things that they've done themselves. So I'm sure as you were doing this, you've had to overcome rejections and push forward. What strategies do you have when you face those rejections yourself?
I've had so many rejections in my life. I feel like everything I've ever done that was meaningful has always come off the heels of rejection. So for example, when I got fired from a job I wasn't even getting paid at Hot 97 because I asked for a paying job, I started a blog site. I really think, like, looking back in the moment, I didn't know what I was doing. In the moment, I was just trying to do anything to get myself to stop feeling so bad and to get myself out of a rut. So I feel like retrospectively, I think number one is like disassociating yourself from your job title, from your company, and making sure that as you're even in the job, you make sure that you don't define yourself by your job title, by where you work. So for example, when I worked at Hot 97, I was Hala from Hot 97. I had dropped out of college. I went back eventually, but I dropped out of college to work at Hot 97. So all my friends from college was like, oh, that's the girl that works at Hot 97. All my social media handles was Hala Hot 97. All my friends were like in the hip hop industry, like my whole identity, I had nothing but the Hot 97 identity. I had fully absorbed myself into that. So when I got fired, it felt like I died. I felt like I had, who am I anymore? Who am I if I'm not Hala from Hot 97? Who am I, right? So no matter if you work for a company or even work for yourself, you've got to make sure that you're not tying your identity to your work, because then anytime you fail, you take it so personally, right? And you really beat yourself down. Whereas if you realize that your job is really important to you, but you're not just your job, you're a loving partner, you're a good friend, you're a pianist, or whatever you are, like whatever your key hobbies are, you are not just your job, right? So that's number one, making sure that no matter what you're doing right now, entrepreneur or corporate professional, you're not tying yourself to some other brand, especially a brand that you don't own that you could get fired from, right? So that's number one. Number two is like when you face rejection, my way to get out of it is to just try to learn something new, to absorb myself in something that's going to get my mind off things, that's going to be beneficial for my future. And so back to the Hot 97 example, when I got fired, I decided I was going to create a blog site. I was going to start something called the Sorority of Hip Hop. And I basically used my pain point as a solution to start something new. So I felt like because I was a young woman in the hip hop industry, I wasn't getting opportunities. So I was going to create a platform to recruit other women in the hip hop industry that felt the same. And we were going to band together, use our resources. I was going to teach them how to blog because I had learned how to blog at the station, and create this website where we could all work together and then create our own platform instead of depending on other people who weren't giving us opportunities. So I like created the solution to the problem that I had, right? And started recruiting other people. And that got me out of the rut. I started learning how to build websites. I started to learn how to code. I had to recruit all these girls and then made friends. And that helped me with coping. And suddenly I had this new blog site that became one of the most popular hip hop and R&B entertainment news websites in about 3 months. And then things just got exciting. And it's who even cares about Hot 97? That's so long ago. And now I have a new thing that I'm working on and excited on. So I think coming up with a way to cope is another way to just get out of it. Learning something new, coming up with a way to cope. So I'll give one more example. That's a recent example. That's not necessarily failure, but a challenge that I had. So I'm Palestinian. And there's a war going on. And for the longest time, being Palestinian was not an afterthought. Like I've got a house there and land there, but it was never a thing, right? Like I've got Jewish clients. I had 20 different Israelis on my show. I had a Holocaust survivor on my show. It never was like a thing. And then suddenly with this Gaza war that's going on, it started like consuming me. And it was just so devastating for me to see everything that's going on and all the killing. And I just felt so helpless. And I felt like I had to talk about it and had to like suddenly become political. And I never wanted to become political. And it was just a very challenging time for me, to be honest, still is. But then I decided, okay, like, what am I going to do to channel this in a productive way instead of getting depressed, instead of feeling down or sad that like I have to deal with this as a Palestinian and nobody else is dealing with it and everyone's going on with normal life as I'm dealing with all this trauma. And so I started a charity project, right? And I recruited other media professionals and I'm creating an audio docuseries on the Gaza conflict as a way to help educate people and unite people. And I started working on that and that's helped me cope. So I think in general, figuring out how you can do something productive, how you can learn something new, do something creative in order to get yourself out of any sort of bad mental state where you're feeling bad about yourself and you're feeling bad about your life.
Well, I'm sorry you've had all that backdrop of what you discussed. And I think it's been going on for too long at this point.
Yeah.
It needs to come to a peaceful conclusion for all parties involved. There were so many things that you brought up that I want to hit on a couple of them. So the first thing you talked about is when you were at HP and then Disney, your brand had become associated with both of those companies. And I felt this same thing. My brand, before I got into podcasting and the book and everything else, was definitely a business executive whose identity was that of the brands that he was representing. And I remember, as I was going down the path to write the book, et cetera, I started to talk to agents, and every agent, book agent, came to me and said, you don't have a brand. No one thinks of you in the confines of how you want to write this book, everything else. And they were very right as I look back upon it, because at that time, those brands weren't encouraging you to have a personal brand. They wanted you to be an extension of their brand, mm-hmm. which benefited them, but did nothing for you personally. And as I think about it now, I think some companies still do that, but I think the benefits of having a personal brand are so important. Even if you're in a company, if someone is going to do a sales call with you or you want to reach out to someone, they are obviously going to research you. And the more information that you can put in the way that you want to be portrayed, the better it helps with that, a new career decision, so recruitment, other things. My point with all of this background is if a person doesn't understand how to create their own personal brand, how do you suggest that they decide on the core elements?
There's multiple steps to figure out your personal brand. So number one, you need to think about your values, right? Your values are who you are in the worst possible circumstances. So essentially your values are your decision-making compass. When you're feeling emotional, what can you look at to figure out how do I make these decisions? What matters in life most to you? The other thing that you need to think about when you're thinking about your personal brand is who are you actually targeting? What is your audience? Because when it comes to creating content on social media and actually attracting people, you need to actually mirror your audience. It's not really about you, it's about them. So what is your audience? What is their age? What is their gender? What is their desires, their interests, right? How can you mirror that in your tonality, mirror that in the way that you communicate so you can talk like them and think like them so that you can actually mirror them and attract them to your profile, right? So you need to think about who your audience is and what parts of you and your brand can mirror them in and bring them into your network, right? The next thing that you need to do is consistency, which is consistency in your messaging. So when it comes to branding, it's really just all about being consistent. If I could come up with one synonym for branding, it would be consistency. So you need to be consistent in your messaging. So that means coming up with 4 or 5 points that you repeat over and over again that people know that's what you represent. That's how you get auto engagement, where people will just share your picture because they already know what you represent. So for example, for me, it's like you're never too old to learn something new. I always talk about how life is limitless, right? And that you can literally do anything you want as long as you work hard. So I've got these messages that I repeat over and over again in a million different ways. Okay. And lastly, you need to figure out how are you going to deliver these messages? What is the mechanism that you're going to deliver these messages? And that really varies from platform to platform and understanding what works on every platform. The other tip I'll give for people who are just starting their personal brand is to do something called a story journal. So this is something that I did when I first started to get asked to go on podcasts. It was really frightening for me because I was always the one on the mic. I had plenty of time for research and study. And suddenly people wanted to ask about me. And suddenly I had to come up with something good to say all the time to any question that anybody asked me, right? And something that I found really helped was creating a story journal. So basically, I sat down and I thought about all the different buckets of my life, childhood, high school, college, my career, starting my podcast. And I thought about all the big milestones and all the stories that I told. So for example, like what was I like as a kid? And like, I'm very entrepreneurial. So I have all these stories about how I started all these businesses when I was like 4 years old, right? And then in high school, like 9/11 and how that impacted me. And then in college with Hot 97 and getting fired and all the different stories I told. And I wrote them down. And I thought about what is the meaning that I want to share behind these stories and how do I want to frame these stories? Later on, I got smarter. Like, how do I actually want to positively frame these stories so that I don't come off as a victim or so that I don't actually hold myself to my past self and think about my past negatively, which is not a good thing, right? And so having a story journal basically gives you material to then write on social media and share your authentic stories. And really the goal is to tell all these stories. You might only have 20 or 40 stories, but you can tell those stories in a million different ways, right? So having those stories in your pocket, people love stories. They learn from stories. It triggers their own stories and wanting to give feedback or sympathy or whatever it is. So you get lots of engagement on stories. So creating a story journal is also a very effective way to kickstart creating content for your personal brand.
I love it. A story journal. Mm-hmm. That's something that I'm going to have to go back myself and do a better job of. Mm-hmm. So another thing that comes to mind when you were talking about your own journey into podcasting is a bridge I crossed myself. And similar to you, I looked at Jordan. He was someone I studied heavily. I was studying Lewis Howes, a number of the other people we've talked about. And I found myself going into the trap of, instead of being my authentic self, I was trying to be like the host that I had studied. And at first, I didn't even realize I was doing it until I started editing my episodes. And I realized that the way I was asking the questions was in the way like they would ask them. And I came to this conclusion, to the point you're making, that if I really want this show to break out, it needs to have its own lane. And I also came to the conclusion that people don't go to Jordan's show or your show or Jay Shetty's because Michelle Obama's on it. Mm. They might, but the bigger reason is because they like Jay Shetty or they like Jordan or they like you. And so I figured out that if I really wanted this thing to work, I had to be known for something and I had to double down on it and really immerse myself in that lens. So I love that you brought that up because for me, that's what hockey stick my podcast. It sounds like for you, that's what hockey sticked your personal brand as well. Once you have all that in the backdrop, how do you utilize different social channels then to expand upon it and get the word out? Because it seems to me, as I'm trying to navigate this, that each one of them is different.
Each one of them is different. And what I would recommend that if you're just starting out, you really want to figure out where your target audience is in mass and where you want to focus. There's no shortcuts in any of this. If you go the shortcut route, what you end up doing is you end up ruining your profile because you just have to keep like paying for boosting and whatever, and nothing's actually real. And there's just no point to doing any of that fake stuff, right? So if you have limited resources, if you can't hire like an award-winning social media agency or somebody to actually help you, what you need to do is just figure out where your audience is in mass and focus on that one platform. So for me, when I started my podcast, I was just working in corporate. I had nothing fancy to my name. I decided that I wasn't even going to post on Instagram. I literally didn't post on Instagram for 2 years. And I only focused on LinkedIn and I posted every day on LinkedIn. And what happens when you post every day is you start to learn what works and what doesn't work. You start to experiment and realize, like, oh, on LinkedIn, if I post a picture of myself, it does a lot better than if I post a video. So I'm just going to keep posting pictures because that's what's working. oh, LinkedIn came out with this new feature and I know about it because I'm on it every single day. Platforms love to push their new features. So why don't I try to experiment with some of these new features? And if it works, I'll keep doing it. And if it doesn't work, I won't do it the next day, right? So doing it every single day, really, you get like instant feedback about how things are working. And that's exactly what happened to me on LinkedIn. I really honestly know the algorithm inside out because I posted on it so much. And then I started a business where I started posting for other people. And so I had all these, aside from my own experiences posting for myself, I knew how to basically run other people's profiles who had totally different circumstances for me. So for example, running Marshall Goldsmith's profile, who had a million followers and zero engagement and was super famous and had all these other things and factors that I didn't have. So figuring out how to resurrect his dead profile, I never had that problem, but I had to re-engineer it for him and figure out how to do it. So then it gave me like a lot of experiences of how to use that specific platform. But back to your question about like, how do I know what platform to focus on? You need to find your target audience in mass. So marketing, that's like the whole thing with marketing. The last thing you want to do is have a platform where there's few and far between of who you're looking for, because it's going to be harder to build a following, harder to get engagement, right? So you need to really figure out where is your target audience. So for Instagram, it's a highly visual platform. It's mostly like millennials and Gen Z. On LinkedIn, it's slightly older, right? Most people are 25 to 54, lots of professionals, lots of entrepreneurs. People have a lot of money. Also primed for sales conversations, right? So that's a really big difference from LinkedIn and Instagram. Is on Instagram, people are trying to escape. People want to have fun. They want to look at food and fashion and dancing and news and like escape. Where on LinkedIn, people are trying to learn. People are learning about their solutions. They're using it for work. They're open to having sales conversations because that's the purpose of the platform, right? So if you're an entrepreneur or a corporate professional, a thought leader, you might want to focus on LinkedIn, which still has a hackable platform and organic reach, where Instagram's very hard to get organic reach right now.
Well, I agree with everything you said, and I promised the audience we'd talk a little bit more about LinkedIn. So since you brought it up, I am having personally a very difficult time understanding the LinkedIn algorithm. You are much better at this than me. I am finding that very few of my posts, even though I post daily, are going viral. And it really frustrates me because I have tried pictures of myself. I have tried audiograms. I have tried videos of my guest. I have tried just doing quote posts. I have tried taking a post that someone else has done and adding content to it all over the place. And I am still not getting the engagement. So maybe if someone is like me and they're getting more and more frustrated with it, what am I doing wrong? And how do you optimize your content for better visibility?
Can I ask you some questions about your profile?
Sure.
How many followers do you have on LinkedIn, and how long have you been using LinkedIn for?
I got in very early. So I've been using it since 2004 or 2005. I wasn't heavily on it when I was working, one, because I didn't have time, two, I really wasn't trying to build a network. So I have, at this point, about 10,000 followers. And that has stayed pretty stagnant. It goes up by maybe a handful a week.
Okay. And how much engagement are you getting on your posts right now, typically?
Probably 10 to 15 people engage on it.
Got it. My students that have 10,000 followers might get 300 to 400 likes on their posts. And the reason is because you probably have a lot of dead, dormant followers. Okay. If you've been on LinkedIn since 2004, have you ever gone back and potentially removed some of your first connections that you had years ago that may never log on to LinkedIn, might not be active, and no longer interested in your content? Have you ever removed any of your 10,000 connections?
No, I have not. But surprisingly, at one point, I had many more followers, like 30 or 40,000, and LinkedIn removed them.
Yeah. So LinkedIn has done a lot of the dirty work for us, which is a good thing. A lot of people were sad about that change. But anybody who knows how to go viral on LinkedIn was removing dead profiles and inactive profiles before that. So for example, when that change happened, so many influencers lost 50,000, 60,000 followers. I lost nothing because that's the game. You've got to remove the dead followers. So I would always do that so that I would go viral. So here's the thing. I'll explain how the LinkedIn algorithm works. Okay. So you put up a post. LinkedIn automatically puts it into filters. These are called spam filters. And LinkedIn's just trying to make sure that you're not putting out something that is inappropriate. So it's going to put your stuff into three buckets, either spam, low quality, or high quality. Okay. So if it goes into spam, you did something wrong. You cursed. You might have put your phone number, your email in the post, nudity, profanity. That's spam. No one's going to see your content. It's dead. Okay. Low quality is stuff that you might not really be aware of. LinkedIn doesn't like one big long paragraph. You've got to have paragraph breaks. LinkedIn doesn't like grammar mistakes. You got to make sure you don't have any grammar mistakes. LinkedIn doesn't like, for example, if you talk about a topic that has no keywords that are not on your profile. So like suddenly you put out a finance post, but you never wrote about finance and you don't have any finance keywords. LinkedIn doesn't want to show that content to other people because you're not a finance expert, right? So there's lots of like low quality things that can get you not totally stopped in your visibility in the feed, but like way less visibility in the feed. And then there's high quality where you've got keywords that match the keywords in your profile. You're talking about topics that you have expertise on. You're utilizing best practices in terms of having proper formatting, and you've got meaningful content and things like that. So you are good to go. You have the potential to go viral because you're in the high quality category. Okay. Second step of the algorithm is why you are failing. It is because LinkedIn is basically servicing your content to a small subset of your first connections. And LinkedIn's basically trying to judge if your content is good or not. And if when you post, you get no initial engagement in what we call the 90-minute golden hour on LinkedIn, the first hour to hour and a half of you posting, you get no engagement because your followers, first connections, don't go on LinkedIn, or they don't take viral action, or they're not interested in your content, then you are going to do bad because LinkedIn's going to think, even if your content is good, that it's boring and it's not working, right? And so one of your things that you want to do on LinkedIn is actually to proactively try to get active, engaging followers, active followers who take viral action on LinkedIn. Now, let's say you did get a decent amount of engagement. Now you're on to the third step of the algorithm, which is all about content scoring. So essentially, as people engage on your LinkedIn posts, every viral action is counted differently. So it's called weighted viral actions. And this was like an aha moment to me because for a long time, whenever I did engagement rates and I would do it for my clients, we would go viral. And then I would used to report that engagement rate went down. I used to always be like, oh, well, because impressions are really big and we are getting a lot more engagement because people were getting 30,000 likes, 100,000 likes. And suddenly their engagement rate was like 0.7 when it used to be 4%. And they would be like, well, our engagement rate is down. And I would always be like, well, it's because impressions are up and engagements did not go as high as impressions. So your engagement rate is down. That's always going to happen. And then it was an aha moment for me when I realized that viral actions are actually weighted. So a like is, we assign it at Yap Media, a like is 1 point, a comment is 2 points, a long comment is 2.5 points, a share is 4 points, a share with a caption is 4.5 points. If you want to go viral on LinkedIn, by far the number one way is to get as many shares with a caption as possible. So you need to make sure that you're optimizing your content for shares. That's how you actually go viral on LinkedIn because it's considered the highest viral action. If somebody shares your stuff, they're like 70% more likely to see your content in their feed the next time they log on. Whereas if they only comment, they're like 50% more likely. If they like it, they're 20% more likely to see it in their feed. And also if their first connection engages, they're like 20% more likely if their connection engages to see that notification. And then same thing, if somebody shares it and you're a first connection with them, you're like 80% more likely to see that notification that your connection shared that post. So it's like shares are what makes you go viral. Total aha moment, right? So you want to optimize for shares on LinkedIn. The other thing that I'll just say, one more thing that's really important is that DMs are super important. And if you don't have a DM strategy, you do not have the ability to really go viral on LinkedIn. DMs, aside from shares, are really the top performing viral action, even though it doesn't happen in your feed. If you DM somebody and they DM you back, they're 85% more likely to see your content the next time they log on. So you need to be continually DMing your first connections. And for example, for you, John, you've got a lot of dormant connections. What I would be doing is actually going on those profiles. If they're inactive, removing them. If they're active, send them a DM that's of value where they'll DM you back so they start seeing your content again. That's called reinvigorating your first connections. So the last step of the algorithm is the fact that LinkedIn is prioritizing professional content. So LinkedIn is actually interested in pushing their agenda of being known as a professional platform because they compete with Indeed and ZipRecruiter as a hiring platform. So therefore, if you use keywords like jobs, workers, management, entrepreneurship, and you use these career type related words and concepts, LinkedIn is more likely to push your content in the feed. There is a point of what you can do on your own, and LinkedIn has basically turn down the gasoline on what you can do on your own. I used to be able to get all my clients to get like 2,000, 3,000 likes a post no matter what. I hacked the algorithm. No matter what, you were getting 2,000, 3,000 likes a post. And then if we aligned to LinkedIn's editorial agenda and we talked about careers, professionalism, or like point in time events, holidays, anything that LinkedIn was pushing, I could get a 30,000 like post, 100,000 like post and go mega viral. LinkedIn actually is what determines. They've got real life editors who are scanning the top posts of the day, and they're deciding what they're turning on to be mega viral or not. So that's the other thing you need to know, is that if you don't align to LinkedIn's editorial agenda, you're not going to go mega viral. If you're trying to sell something, you're not going to go mega viral. LinkedIn only wants to push what they want to push in their feed to go super viral. Hopefully that helps.
No, that's super interesting, and in some ways sitting here super intimidating. The other question I have is, I've experienced gains and then drops. I started doing a newsletter. At first, it was pretty popular, and then I stopped getting engagement as more and more people started doing them. So my question comes down to content types. Articles versus posts versus videos, et cetera. What is the best to use?
Really great question. There's definitely hot or not features on LinkedIn. They're changing all the time. So back to your newsletter thing, we did a study at Yap Media last year. And for clients who posted newsletters versus not, the clients who posted newsletters overall did 30% worse in the feed. And so we recommended for a long time to no longer do newsletters. Now I have some people like Heather Monahan who are like, Hala, my newsletter is rocking. I do her LinkedIn too, but sometimes she'll just do stuff on her own. And she swears her newsletter is working again. So everything's always changing, right? And you always need to reevaluate what's working, what's not working. I would say right now, by far, the best performing asset are pictures, okay? Photographs. People really connect to human faces, the whites of your eyes, the whites of your teeth. If you're mirroring the way that your audience looks, like you're dressed really professional, or you're in like a, I'm not talking about like a white background headshot. I'm talking about like you sitting at a desk, you want a computer, you want a phone, something that's relatable. A lifestyle photograph with a story that works super well on LinkedIn. And then when it comes to the actual content on LinkedIn, something that I just want to make sure is super clear is that everything on all social media platforms are now really shifting towards interest relevancy and not really engagement and virality. These platforms more and more don't want you to go viral. They just want to make sure your content is reaching the right people and keeping people on the platform for as long as possible. So a lot of it is based on keywords across all platforms, not just LinkedIn. So you need to think about, what are like the four topics that I'm going to talk about over and over again? What are those keywords? What are those sub keywords? And how am I going to infuse that in all of my posts, right? The other thing that's like new and trending on LinkedIn supposedly is videos. So vertical videos in particular, they just opened up a new part of their feed where they're competing with Reels and TikTok. LinkedIn has tried to do this in the past and it hasn't really worked out, but a lot of people are saying they're getting more traction on their videos. It's something that we're testing. Polls. So polls were really hot like a year and a half ago, then like everybody was doing polls and suddenly LinkedIn was a poll platform and they didn't like that. So then they pulled the plug on polls and they did really bad. Now they're doing good again. Just the thing to think about with polls is that votes are basically likes. So you really want to pay, you really want to combine your likes and your votes to try to see like how it actually performed. And they get a lot of impressions. So like polls are a really easy way to make sure that you post every day because it takes 2 minutes to just like put up a poll and they get a lot of engagement. So those would be like the main ways. I do see some influencers lately, like Alex Ramosi, doing like text-only posts that are going super viral. So I would say get creative for sure. Stick with the staples, photographs and stories with meaningful content that has keywords. I think that will do a great job for you. And the other things I mentioned are things that are trending as well.
I guess the other thing I've been told not to do that I've been trying to is anything that takes them away from LinkedIn. So don't put links, for instance, in the body of a post. If you're going to put a link like to a podcast episode, do it in the comments below. Is that accurate?
That's not a thing anymore. This is something that like last year I was teaching that you can't put an external link. Now LinkedIn has totally changed their algorithm. So in general, LinkedIn is more about interest relevancy and keywords than they are virality and going viral. And one of the changes that they've done in all of this is that they're allowing you to promote whatever links that you want in the caption now. And so we see very little difference in performance now. And so now I'm putting links in almost all of my captions because I'm not getting penalized for it.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked you because
it's a big one because it's counterintuitive. I'm sure they're going to change it again. That's the thing. They're always changing things.
They are. Well, I wanted to ask you, Hala, about influence science. Are there some psychological principles that you believe are essential for building influence?
Oh, yes. This is such a good one. So I'm glad that you brought this up because one of the first books that I want to write is actually about how to use some of these learnings of influence that I've learned from amazing people on my podcast, like Robert Cialdini and Chris Voss and all these things, and how to actually take those strategies and use them online. So I'll talk about a couple of them. Number one, the law of reciprocity. This is one from Robert Cialdini. So what this basically means is that if you give to somebody and serve somebody, they feel compelled to give something back from to you or to buy from you, for example. So on social media, you really want to think about being of service. How can you give? Because then you grow your social capital so you can make an ask so that when you sell a course or you have an offering or whatever, people are going to buy from you because you've just given them so much, right? So you always want to think about like, what is your lead gen tool? What is the free thing that you're going to give away? What is the best thing that you have that you can give away for free where people will value it so much and then feel like they're obligated to do something back for you, whether that's write you a review, support your posts and write comments, buy your course or whatever it is. So law of reciprocity is huge on social media. The other thing that if we're going to talk about Robert Cialdini is like the laws of likability. Right? So people like people who are like them. People like people who share shared identities, who ask them questions. And you can use all of these strategies to have super engaging DM and invite campaigns. One of the things that I mentioned to you earlier, John, is that you really want to, on LinkedIn specifically, you want to be able to recruit people to your profile who take viral action, who will engage on your stuff. And one of the things that you need to do is actually find these people, invite them to your network and get them to like you. So they start accepting your invites and engaging on your stuff. You need to be likable, right? So what does that mean? I'll give you an example. When I started on LinkedIn, I thought that Gary Vee had an audience that I wanted. People were calling me the young female Gary Vee. He had a podcast. He talked marketing. He talked motivation. I thought anybody who likes this stuff is going to like mine too. I went on his content, his posts, and I saw anybody who recently liked or commented on his posts, I invited to my network. At the time, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know the impacts of what I was doing. I directionally thought it was right, but I didn't know that in reality, you need people who take viral action and that DMs are the highest viral action and all. I didn't know any of that stuff that I just taught you guys before. So people who recently liked stuff on Gary Vee's profile are showing a few things. A, they take viral action. They like, comment, they share. Okay. So you want to prioritize by that. Who's sharing, who's commenting, who's liking, because the sharers are the gold mine that you want to reach out to because they'll likely share your stuff. They take those kinds of viral action, right? So you want to pull those active people to your profile. The other thing is that they were interested in similar content. So those are two things that told me this is my target audience. I could go deeper and look at their titles and look at where they work and all these other things. But those were two factors that were good enough, right? And Gary Vee is what I call a lookalike profile. And you can find lots of lookalike profiles. They don't have to be your competitor. It could be anybody who has an audience that you want, okay? You go on their page. Whoever's liking and commenting is your target audience. So then I use the laws of likability to attract them to my page. Hey, I noticed you're also a fan of Gary Vee. I would love to be connected and provide value on your feed. So what am I doing? People like people who are like them. I noticed that you're also a fan of Gary Vee, right? The other thing I could do is pay somebody a compliment. I noticed you're also a rock star female entrepreneur. I'd love to get connected, right? So people love compliments. I could do something else and say, hey, I noticed that you're an expert in the finance space. I'd love your advice on XYZ, right? People love giving advice, especially when they're not celebrities and they don't get asked for advice all the time, right? So using some of these laws of likability, shared identities, hey, I noticed that you also went to NYU. I'd love to connect with you on my feed and provide value. So using these kind of laws to get people to like you and accept you, the laws of reciprocity, like I mentioned, are just some of the few ways that I use psychology and all the things that I've learned on my podcast on social media.
So I need to go back to LinkedIn just for a second here.
Sure.
So if you're not paying for one of their tools, it only lets me reach out to a handful of people every single month, and then it shuts me down from sending new DMs.
Yeah.
So how do you get around that?
Yeah. So DMs are unlimited, but invites are not. And this is new, right? Again, things are always changing. Now you need to buy premium, which I think is like, I want to say $20 a month, max $40 a month to get unlimited invites, or not unlimited invites, more invites. You get 75 a week or something, but DMs are unlimited. So really the game, John, as you become a bigger influencer on LinkedIn, is to get your max first connections, 30,000 connections. Okay. So for example, right now I have 245,000 followers on LinkedIn. Okay. I have 30,000 first connections. I am constantly removing those first connections and adding new ones that I want to be able to DM. And my team is in the DMs literally 24 hours a day soliciting my first connections. We're doing things like post retargeting. Anytime I do a post, we have an associated retargeting DM that goes along with that post. For example, I have a BetterHelp webinar. If I'm posting about mental health in my BetterHelp webinar, my team, anybody who hasn't gotten a DM in X amount of days is getting a DM inviting them to my webinar. Even if I already promoted it in the post, they're getting spoon-fed the link in their DMs. Another thing that's going on is we might be going to events and groups, seeing who's signing up for entrepreneurship events or entrepreneurship groups. Hey, I noticed that you're also a fellow entrepreneur. I'd love to invite you to listen to my number one entrepreneurship podcast, Young and Profiting, right? They respond back. Oh my gosh, I loved your show. It was so good, blah, blah, blah. Thank you. Can you copy and paste this as an Apple Podcast review? That's how I stay number one in the charts, right? So we're DMing 24/7 on LinkedIn because DMs are unlimited to your 30,000 connections. So it's super important. You're always like pruning those connections, bringing in new ones, and continually just like making sure it's people that are engaged with you, want to buy from you. You don't need to DM more than 30,000 people if you're just always bringing new people in, if that makes sense.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. And the last thing I wanted to talk to you about is something we haven't really engaged on, is you've taken what you've doing with the podcast, and you've now grown one of the fastest growing podcast networks. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that attracted to me what you're doing is you're building online communities that don't just engage, but are also making purchases, which I think is extremely important. How important is content strategy for fostering a community that trusts and values your offerings?
So important, because you need to be in your integrity. You need to be trustworthy in order for people to want to actually pay you. So this goes back to my initial thoughts about being of service. I love to just give away free content. Every single month, I put out an hour-long webinar that I bust my butt for and actually teach people things for free. And this creates super fans. This creates trust. This creates the ability for me to then sell on my podcast, sell on my feed, sell my courses, because everybody knows that not only do I sell, but I give a lot of stuff away for free. And people appreciate the fact that I'm not just trying to only just sell to them, and that there's options if they can't afford it to learn for free. But guess what? All the people who are learning for free from me, they attend 2-3 webinars. By the fourth one, they've saved up their money to get the real deal because they know how much value they've gotten. So it's just so important to try to be of service to everyone, whether or not they're going to buy from you, knowing that it's a long game, that if you keep investing in your audience, they will invest in you back.
And then lastly, what techniques have you found to be the most effective in converting your online community members into customers?
Good question. So I would say a couple things that I've alluded to. Number one is content retargeting. So closing the loop. It's not enough to, for example, let's say you're trying to get people to convert to listen to your podcast. It's not enough to just put up a little micro content reel and then expect people to do all the legwork, to go on Google, search the episode, find the episode, even to go to your story and find the link. You need to spoon feed it to them. So anyone who's liking and commenting on your post is basically raising their hand and saying, you have permission to message me. I took the first action. I took a behavioral action. Now you can message me and you won't come off as spammy. You'll come off as helpful. Hey, I noticed that you engaged on my recent post about my latest podcast. I'd love to give you the link to the episode. Here's the link. Let me know your thoughts. Now you're helpful. You're not spammy. They took the first action. So retargeting your posts, closing the loop, making sure that every single post that you have has some sort of retargeting action where you're engaging people in the DMs. That's really important. Number two is webinars. I love doing webinars now. So for example, I have an upcoming LinkedIn masterclass coming out in September. And so what I'm going to do leading up to that is put out free content, free webinars, where basically I go on social media, I promote these webinars, I invite people to come. It's a private Zoom webinar. They've got to put their name and their email in order to register. So now I have a couple ways to reach out to them. They're either following me on LinkedIn or Instagram, and now I have their email where I can message them on email as well and try to get them to convert. So I have this webinar and it's usually 2 hours long. I'm giving away so much free content, real strategies they can learn, engaging people in a two-way manner, staying on and just doing Q&A live so that they can hear my credibility, hear my expertise, understand how I can help them personally. And we get super high conversions. And the thing is, like I said before, people will show up 2-3 times and that's okay. They're not going to convert necessarily the first time, but I'm creating super fans. I'm creating trust and people who are helping me in other ways. Maybe they can't afford to buy my course, but now they're going to tell their friends about me. Now they're going to listen to my podcast every day. They're going to engage on my social media and help me grow my brand. So things that offer two-way communication are definitely the strongest to sell online. So live streams, webinars, those are the two strongest ways to actually convert people on social media, and then DMs, which is another personal way to connect with people.
Well, Hala, thank you so much for everything you've discussed today. It was pretty enlightening for me, and I'm sure for our listeners as well, because we don't do this type of episode very often. If someone wants to learn more about you and your brand and what you're doing, where's the best place for them to go?
Cool. So if anybody wants to learn LinkedIn from me, I have a 2-day workshop coming up in September, yapmedia.io/course. And if you want to get 30% off, you can use code John. So just John's name, J-O-H-N. You can get 30% off. If you guys want the podcast, Young and Profiting, I interview the brightest minds in the world. I just had Gary Vee on the show. I've had people like Alex Ramosi, Seth Godin, amazing people. I unpack their entrepreneurship stories. I really focus on one topic. I love to talk about sales, human behavior, leadership, mental health, all those kinds of things. So if you're an entrepreneur, you'd love my show. And my company is called Yap Media. If you guys want social services or are interested in the podcast network, you can go to yapmedia.com.
Interestingly enough, I just released an episode with Gary Vee myself today.
Oh, cool. So, congrats.
There you go. All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. It was such an honor to have you.
Thanks, John.
I thoroughly enjoyed that interview with Hala Taha. And I wanted to thank Hala and Hannah Clark for the honor and privilege of joining us on Passion Struck. Links to all things Hala will be in the show notes at passionstruck.com. Please use our website links if you purchase any of the books from the guests that we feature here on the show. Videos are on YouTube at both our main channel at John R. Miles and our Clips channel at Passion Struck Clips. Please go subscribe and join over 250,000 other subscribers. Advertiser deals and discount codes are in one convenient place at passionstruck.com/deals. Please consider supporting those who support the show. Do you want a daily dose of Passion Struck inspiration? Then follow me at John R. Miles on all the social platforms. And if you want to express your courage muscles in a more meaningful way, then sign up for our weekly courage movement, which you can do by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Live Intentionally, where in every issue, I post a weekly challenge that's based and inspired on the episodes that we did the previous week. Just go to passionstruck.com to take the challenge. Curious to know if you're an imitator or a vanquisher in the great game of life? Then take the Passion Struck quiz, which consists of just 20 questions and only take about 10 minutes of your time. And it shows you where you are on the continuum to becoming Passion Struck. You can also find it at passionstruck.com. Join me on the next episode of Passion Struck, where I sit down with my friend Michael McCourt, the CEO of EpiOne and a visionary in the fight against cancer. From his roots in West Berlin to leading groundbreaking innovations in early cancer detection, Michael's journey is one of resilience, personal loss, and unwavering dedication. Discover how his mission to revolutionize cancer diagnostics is making a profound impact in healthcare. This is an episode you don't want to miss.
I firmly believe we're at an inflection point in terms of the amount of resources that have gone into cancer research. When I meet young researchers, old researchers, I can see it in their eyes that they're saying, we're starting to figure this out. I was introduced about a year and a half ago to a woman in New York City that had made a discovery that the best way I can explain it to your listeners is that there's a section of the DNA molecule, section of the genome, that has been forgotten by science. It's a big molecule. And you say, oh, yeah, that part we don't really worry about. And she discovered it's an epigenetic section of the DNA molecules, maybe the way to say it, that when cells turn cancerous, at the very beginning when it's really stage zero, when cells turn cancerous, that there is a signal. It's not a radio signal, but almost like a signal that starts broadcasting on that part of the DNA molecule that is so strong that if you know what you're looking for, if you don't know what you're looking for, you'll never hear it or you'll never see it. But if you know what you're looking for, you can actually detect it with very standard laboratory equipment. And so when you first hear this, you're like, wow, there's no way. And frankly, that was my reaction.
The fee for this show is that you share it with family or friends when you find something useful or inspirational. If you found the content that we shared today with Hala inspirational, then share it with your family and friends. The greatest compliment that you can give the show is to share it with those that you love and care about. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so that you can live what you listen. Until next time, go out there and become passion struck.